This economy doesn't run all by itself, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 30th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Supreme Court of the United States wrapped up what can only be called a momentous 2021-2022 sitting today in the case called West Virginia versus EPA, in which Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for a 6-3 majority, limited what the Environmental Protection Agency can do to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants in this economy. That's the headline about this case, which you have surely already heard or seen today. What you might probably really didn't hear or see is the phrase administrative state and what this case means for that. I had a conversation about the administrative state with Blake Emerson last week. He's a professor of law at UCLA, and we've gotten him back on the phone now that the case is out. Professor Emerson, good to have you back on, sir.
Hi, Kai. It's good to be here.
So the headline, as I said a minute ago, is, of course, about the EPA and climate change, but it's not really about the EPA and climate change, this case, is it?
That's right. So the narrow holding of this case is about the EPA's authority to regulate climate change, but its significance is really much broader than that. The opinion is likely to severely restrict many federal agencies' ability to issue health and safety regulations on issues involving the marketplace, involving consumer financial products, as well as issues such as the COVID-19 pandemic, which is ongoing.
All right. So look, if you are a mid or even high level staff attorney at the Securities and Exchange Commission, thinking about, I don't know, crypto, or if you're at the Food and Drug Administration thinking about whatever the FDA lawyers think about, you're reading this case and saying to yourself, what?
So I think the natural inclination of government attorneys is going to be more cautious. So yeah, so if the SEC is thinking about taking steps to regulate how cryptocurrency works or how it's exchanged, SEC attorneys are going to look at this opinion and say, let's make certain that this court, as well as district courts and appellate courts across the country, aren't going to think, oh, this looks like a really big exercise of authority. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts, in this opinion, used this really telling language where he said that where regulation raises eyebrows, that's something we're going to be skeptical about. The thing about raising eyebrows is depends on whose eyebrows. It's going to depend on the ideological predilections of the judge, whether or not they are skeptical of the regulation or think it's a good idea.
Well, so let's keep going with crypto and the eyebrows then, because as we've seen in the crypto market, not to beat up on crypto and or judges, as I'm about to do, but there's been a lot of eyebrow-raising activity in cryptocurrency, and one can't really know what the rules are going to be now, can one?
So certainly I think that it is going to open up a new chapter in what agency attorneys have to think about on issues such as crypto. So prior to rulings like this one, the way agency attorneys would think about a problem is if a statute says uses a word like security, we are the ones who figure out what that word means within the bounds of Congress's broad directions.
Yeah, to be clear, security here as in a tradable thing that happens in financial markets, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that was the old way administrative law worked. Now, if you look at the opinion today, it seems like the court is saying that rule doesn't apply if we think the issue is a big issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe something like cryptocurrency is big enough that it qualifies. Now, to be clear, I don't want to suggest at all that SEC doesn't have authority to issue regulations on crypto, or that the court, it would stop it from doing so. But it's that sort of problem that every agency is going to be thinking about and is likely to lead them to be more cautious.
Yeah, but you know what? Let's think about what the court actually said about who should be making these rules. And look, I read it, and I'm not a lawyer, but I can read English. And basically what the Chief Justice said was, hey, it's up to Congress. And there are members of Congress who can't spell crypto, let alone regulate it.
Right. So on the one hand, it's definitely true that Congress does not have the expertise and also is politically paralyzed to answer these sorts of complex questions. But that's exactly why Congress creates administrative agencies like the SEC. The whole idea is that, well, we're going to give over these difficult nitty-gritty problems over to executive branch agencies, and they're going to have experts who know what they're doing, and also they're going to get input from the affected public. The problem with this ruling and rulings like it is that the court is taking away that policymaking power. And that is something to worry about because the court does not have the same expertise as the agencies, and it does not have the same political accountability. Yeah. You can't fire federal judges.
So in the final analysis, do you think this is the case on the administrative state and how this economy gets run, or is it a case and there's more to come?
I think this is a case and that there are more to come. I mean, I think it's a very important one. This is a case that is going into the administrative law textbooks, no doubt. I don't think, however, that this is going to be the last word on these issues. And one thing to look out for is this non-delegation doctrine, which is this idea that Congress constitutionally cannot give agencies too broad policymaking power. And there are still appears to be a majority of justices on the court who want to apply that doctrine that's been dead since the 1930s. And I would not be surprised to see that doctrine come back in a future case.
Blake Emerson is a professor of law at UCLA. Professor Emerson, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Kai. Take care.
The first half of the 2022 trading year came to a merciful close. Today, we will have the details when we do the numbers. A little inflation now, and we're going to frame it this way. What is the Federal Reserve to do when the number that it likes to look at as a gauge of rising prices, something called PCE, personal consumption expenditures, which came out this morning, what happens when that isn't what regular people like to look at, something called the Consumer Price Index, CPI, and their impression of rising prices? Lest you think this is merely a program on business and the economy looking for an unusual angle on the otherwise well-chewed-over story about inflation in this economy. Well, yeah, maybe it is. But also, this is an actual thing. Allow me to introduce Marketplace's Sabri Benishour.
According to the PCE, prices rose 6.3% in May from last year. Another inflation index, the CPI, put that number at a much scarier 8.6%. So what are we supposed to believe, the scary number or the extra scary number? Well, they measure different things. Here's Joe Gagnon with the Peterson Institute.
The big differences are that the CPI...
CPI is the extra scary one.
CPI includes more housing and gasoline, which gasoline went way up in May. And housing has been going up faster lately, and that's more important than CPI.
The PCE, that's the less scary one, includes more healthcare costs that haven't been rising as much. But more important than which measure you look at is what they are doing over time. If you look at yet another measure of inflation, the core PCE, which takes out energy and food, it's been falling steadily from 5.3% in February down to 4.7% in May. Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at Luthold Group, finds that
really encouraging to some degree.
Now, there is one thing that can really mess with what inflation is doing, and that is what people think inflation will do, what economists call expectations. Lawrence Ball is professor of economics at Johns Hopkins.
The basic reason expectations is important is quite simple, that inflation can be self-fulfilling.
If people expect inflation in the long term, that can cause inflation.
If I'm a company deciding on my prices, if I think there's going to be inflation, so my costs will go up, I will want to raise my prices along with that.
Consumer inflation expectations for the short term ticked up in May, long term ticked down. So if some of our inflation journey is going to be determined by our mindset, well, our collective mindset is not clear. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Since the Supreme Court's draft opinion overruling Roe v. Wade was leaked last month, abortion rights supporters have been trying to figure out fundamentally what to do. And one of the ideas is that Native American reservations could kind of be safe havens for people who need reproductive care, but who live in states where abortion is now either illegal or sharply limited. Tribal nations are sovereign, right? They've got their own laws and court systems that are independent from the states that surround them. So some advocates were asking, can't abortion clinics just set up shop on a reservation to get around the bans? As Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports, it's not that simple by a long shot.
Last Friday, after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Rachel Lorenzo was at a rally in Albuquerque, handing out condoms and spreading the word about the abortion fund at the nonprofit Indigenous Women Rising.
Have you heard of us? We're one of the abortion funds in New Mexico, but we serve Native
Lorenzo, who's Laguna Pueblo and Mescalero Apache, started the fund in 2018 to help Native people afford abortion care.
Our first year that we launched, we served maybe like 50 people.
Since then, donations to the fund have ramped up. So have abortion restrictions in a couple of states with high Native populations.
We've served now over 600 people, people who are traveling from Texas. Now people are traveling from Oklahoma.
And not just because those state governments restrict access. Long before this recent wave of anti-abortion legislation, reservations were abortion care deserts.
We see like rhetoric on social media or in the news like, Roe v. Wade is the end. This, like, the sky is falling. But the sky has been falling for Native people specifically. We've been living in the apocalypse without full bodily autonomy.
Lorenzo says anyone who's been volunteering tribal lands to fill new gaps in abortion access is missing some crucial context, like what kind of health care is accessible on tribal lands to begin with.
The primary provider of health care in Indian country is the federal government.
Isla Haas is an attorney focused on tribal public health. She says the government provides this care to fulfill its trust and treaty obligations to tribal nations. But
because that system is federally funded, it's going to be covered by the Hyde Amendment.
The Hyde Amendment. That's the measure that says federal dollars through programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and the Indian Health Service can't go toward abortion care, except under rare exceptions. That's why getting an abortion in Indian country is already complicated, and why closing that gap isn't as simple as a tribe opening an abortion clinic.
To get around the Hyde Amendment, that means if a tribe wants to provide those services, that they have to segregate their funds and provide non-federal funding for those services.
Some tribes have the resources to do that. Most probably don't. So far, none have volunteered. And yet, experts are still fielding questions about the possibility of legal havens for abortion on tribal land. Experts like Stacy Leeds, a professor of Indian law at Arizona State University and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation.
A lot of the calls that I've been receiving suggest that a non-Native person might go inside Indian country to access some sort of healthcare service. You know, that's simply not happening.
At least for abortions, if they've been criminalized under state law. And yesterday, the Supreme Court seemed to really close the door on that possibility by expanding states' criminal jurisdiction over non-natives in Indian country. Those barriers aside, Leeds says this conversation, which has largely been led by non-natives, is tone deaf.
It comes against the backdrop of a lack of full reproductive rights.
For Native people, whose recent history includes traumas like forced sterilization and forced removal of their children to boarding schools and non-Native adoptive homes. In Albuquerque, Rachel Lorenzo, with Indigenous Women Rising, doesn't have a lot of patience for the lingering discussion of a reservation loophole for abortion.
Stop asking me.
Instead, they're focused on the deluge of requests for help that are likely to flood in now that Roe is overturned and that their abortion fund doesn't have the capacity to handle.
I really need help making sure that we can expand our staff because the staff we have are so incredible, but we're tired. All of us are very tired.
In June, Indigenous Women Rising spent all $10,000 of its monthly budget on the first of the month. This past week, it's seen an influx of donations, so it has twice as much to spend in July. In Albuquerque, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This is a parfait. Would you like one?
Well, don't mind if I do. Thank you very much. First, though, let's do the numbers. To close out the market's worst first half of a year in decades, like literally back to the 1970s, Dow Jones Industrial Average down 253 today, 0.8%, 30,775. The NASDAQ down 149 points, 1.3%, 11,028. The S&P 500 down 33 points, 0.9%, 37.85. Bed Bath & Beyond announced this week it's replacing its CEO. Company reported a big slump in sales in its first quarter. Bed Bath & Beyond slipped down 0.4% today. Target also down 0.4%. Starting tomorrow, the big three credit reporting firms are going to stop including paid medical debt in their credit scoring. Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion are also going to lengthen the time before medical debt appears on credit reports from 6 months to a year. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, which is, in fact, one of those agencies that Professor Emerson was talking about, CFPB says roughly 20% of U.S. households report they have medical debt totaling about $88 billion. Obviously, that gets on your credit report. Worse credit score means you have less access to credit, which is, of course, how this economy goes around. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.01%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Let's pick up on the inflation story here for a second that Sabria was talking about. Along with PCE, the other important slice of the macroeconomic pie that we got today was on the two-thirds or so of this economy that is spending by or on behalf of consumers. It ran really hot in 2021 and earlier this year, but it started to taper off. Personal spending was up just 0.2% in May. That's after a 0.6% bump in April. Personal incomes were up, yes, but still not enough to keep up with rising prices. And so it is thanks to those rising prices, along with the rising cost of borrowing interest rates, right? Thank you, Jay Powell. It's because of that that consumers are finally starting to pull back. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Consumer spending is slowing down, but remains pretty robust. Demand strong enough to support retailers that are still trying to staff up. A lot of consumers still have savings built up from pandemic stimulus checks, and people feel pretty confident they're going to keep their jobs. But, says Chris Jackson at polling firm Ipsos,
we also ask about people's current financial conditions, and those numbers have just been getting worse and worse and worse. And right now, they're as bad as we've seen them really ever.
The cost of everything going up is to blame, says Jackson. Basics like food and gasoline, rent and medical bills, and anything discretionary like going out or taking a vacation.
People feeling like they can't afford stuff, and people being scared that maybe they won't be able to afford stuff in the future.
And people are starting to act on those feelings and fears, says John Lear at Morning Consult, by holding off on big purchases.
Given all the economic uncertainty that's out there right now, consumers are increasingly saying that they're no longer planning on buying a car or buying a house.
That's for higher income consumers who could maybe stretch a little and afford them. But Lear says lower income consumers increasingly have a choice to make.
Use whatever modest savings you have to make ends meet, or do you take on additional credit to make those purchases? We're seeing a little bit of both.
It is frightening. It is disruptive.
Mark Cohen directs retail studies at Columbia Business School.
And it all speaks to a lack of confidence in the future.
To slightly tweak a famous Betty Davis quote, Cohen said, "Fasten your seatbelts. We're in for a very bumpy ride." I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Most of the aid programs that the government runs are means tested. That means in order to be eligible, applicants have to prove they are below a certain income level. That's true of SNAP, sometimes called food stamps. It's true of housing assistance and Medicaid. And it used to be true about free or reduced priced school lunch programs. Then came the pandemic. And for the last 2 years, Washington has let schools offer free breakfast and lunch year round, regardless of income. That waiver expired at the end of June, though, so means testing is back in some states. California and Maine and Vermont have made universal free lunch permanent starting this fall. Other states are considering doing the same. Marketplace's Samantha Fields explores means testing and what it really means.
Abby Ratliff makes just a little too much for her kids to get free or reduced price meals at school. She and her husband looked into it last fall when their oldest was starting kindergarten.
And we didn't qualify, so then we were really excited when we saw that it's available for everyone.
Ratliff and her husband live in Durham, North Carolina, with their kids, who are 6, 3, and almost 2.
What's up, ladies?
Good morning. This is a parfait. Would you like one?
She's a nurse, and for the last few years, he's been a stay-at-home dad. At first, it felt pretty doable living on just her salary, but
the past year, it's felt harder. The groceries have skyrocketed, and, you know, gas prices are crazy.
So she says not having to pay for lunches for their oldest daughter was really helpful. There are a lot of families that struggle to put enough food on the table, yet make too much to qualify for free or reduced-price school meals.
We know typically that almost a third of food insecure households in the United States have incomes above that cutoff.
Elaine Waxman at the Urban Institute says allowing schools to offer a universal free lunch helped keep a lot of kids from going hungry during the worst of the pandemic.
It's also given us an eye into what really research was already telling us, which is that making meals universally available can bring a lot of benefits that people might not anticipate.
Like improving test scores, reducing discipline issues, and decreasing stigma for kids who do qualify for free lunch, she says. It's also easier for schools because it means they don't have to deal with determining who's eligible. And it's easier for families.
Some of the families you most want to reach through means-tested programs are the ones who are going to struggle the most to document income, resources, or lack thereof.
Indi Duttagupta at the Center for Law and Social Policy says that's true with the National School Lunch Program and with other government benefits like SNAP and Medicaid.
Sometimes these means-tested or targeted programs can exclude the very families who you want to reach.
Programs that are universal or nearly universal, he says, do a better job of actually reaching the people who need them most.
But you got to recognize that it's much more expensive.
Bob Greenstein is with the Brookings Institution.
In Western Europe, more programs are universal. How do they do it? They raise a lot more in taxes.
And in the U.S., increasing taxes is generally a non-starter. So Greenstein says, given that reality,
if you have a limited amount of resources, you can do far more to meet people in the most need by targeting the resources rather than spreading them over everybody all the way to the top of the income scale.
But, he says, target a program too narrowly and it likely won't get a lot of popular support. Target it more broadly and it will. Think Social Security and Medicare, last year's temporary expansion of the child tax credit, and universal free school lunch. All very popular. Although Congress let those last two expire. For now, Abby Ratliff and her husband are trying to figure out how they're going to make ends meet this fall. Her husband is going back to school, and they're going to have to start paying for daycare for their two youngest kids.
So with the ending of the free lunch program for all, that definitely added a stressor to us going into next year.
Anybody want some fresh strawberries from out back?
They're still doing okay, but they pretty much only spend money on necessities now.
We feel like we've already cut back a lot on what we can. I mean, truly, to the bare minimum, and changed what we buy at the grocery store.
They've also planted a fruit and vegetable garden, which helps them cut back on their grocery bill even more.
I like blackberries.
You like the blackberries? Good. Those are the wild ones from out back.
And they've made a spreadsheet of all the community food pantries and food banks nearby, just in case. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today as we head into the 4th of July weekend. Data from the American Farm Bureau, Big Ag's lobbying arm, yes, saw this on Bloomberg the other day. The average holiday cookout this year going to cost you 17% more. Beef and chicken and pork and beans, they are all up. Prices for strawberries and sliced cheese, though, well, they're down. All right, we're out of here. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. If you are driving somewhere this weekend, good-ish news. A gallon of gas, national average, says AAA, $4.85, down a penny from yesterday, down about a dime from a week ago. Can you tell, by the way, that I'm off tomorrow from what I'm thinking about? Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Thanks, by the way, to everybody around here who's working both tomorrow, but also Monday, because the show's got to get on, right? I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.